let the little children come to me, baptizing all nations. And there's no fine print that says excluding little children and infants and little ones.
Pastor Chris Roseborough speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
You'll note then that the man-made baptismal theology that sounds so reasonable and rational because it turns baptism into a symbol, into an ordinance, into a work, that what it's doing is running against the very will of God by keeping children away from the Word of God for them in the waters of baptism.
You can listen to Chris Roseborough's presentation, Making the Case for Infant Baptism, on a recording of the 2018 Making the Case Conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible contribution of $300. Learn more at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
You go into your high school government class and you give your opinion defending marriage as between a man and a woman, the class is not going to look at you and say, how brave. Your classmates are going to look at you and say, how intolerant.
They're opposed to femininity, but they're also opposed to masculinity. The worst being in the world is a man. The best being in the world is a male individual who is feminized.
Because on the other side of death for the Christian is not condemnation, is not judgment, but is Jesus who welcomes us and blesses us.
Northern Illinois Chainsaw Drivers, love, issues, etc.
The last time we were talking about the U.S. Constitution with Dr. Russell Dunn in our series on the Constitution, we talked about those Civil War amendments that fundamentally changed the shape of the U.S. government in a way that really has had its effect on into our present day. But the changing and the reshaping was not over. Today, we're going to be talking about how the Commerce Clause of the Constitution has been interpreted by Congress and later by courts to, again, go pretty much outside the lines that were drawn by the framers of the U.S. Constitution. We'll also discuss the 16th Amendment, that income tax amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Greetings and happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. In Hour 2 of Issues Etc., we're going to look forward to the last Sunday of the church year, according to the three-year lectionary with Dr. Carl Fakencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Joining us for part 6 of our series on the U.S. Constitution, today we'll talk about the Commerce Clause and the 16th Amendment. Dr. Russell Dunn, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dunn, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
If you would, review what we've discussed so far.
Okay, well, last time we began talking about challenges to America's constitutional governance. We opened with the problem of state-level abuse of power in the extreme form of slavery. The southern states had deprived African slaves of their natural rights and had done so thoroughly and so completely that the Federalist relationship, the relationship between the central government and the state governments, had to be altered and altered forever. That abuse of power could not be allowed to stand. So today we'll pick up from there and discuss two additional challenges to constitutional governments. As you mentioned, the Commerce Clause and basically how that clause has been interpreted, and also the 16th Amendment.
This next question really could be a book or a doctoral dissertation in and of itself. But if you would, talk about the growth of the federal government since the ratification of the Constitution. And if you can, did the framers anticipate this growth adequately?
To answer the second part first, no, they did not anticipate the growth adequately. But in their defense, I'm not sure that it would have been possible for them to do so. So much of the growth of the central government has come from the expansion of technology. We couldn't have a federal government this involved in our lives if not for all the amazing innovations of the 19th century, such as the railroads, etc., and then also now the 20th and 21st centuries getting into the digital age. But the first part of your question was, well, what is this expansion? And to try to narrow down the dissertation, it is simply an unrecognizable degree of federal intrusion. Some of that intrusion has had benefits, some of it has had detriments, but regardless, the government of today is unrecognizably involved in our daily lives. And I say unrecognizably, what I mean by that is that there was no way that the founders of our republic could have envisioned that it would be this intrusive, and they would not recognize it as the government that they created.
A thought occurs here, and the term that's rolling around in my head is smaller government, and I think often there's some ambiguity to that term. Sometimes when it's used, it is meant exactly as you have just described, trying to scale back the intrusion of the federal government into our lives. And sometimes it's meant fewer governmental employees, a cheaper government. What are your thoughts?
Right. Well, I think that with one comes the other. With a larger employment role in the federal government comes more intrusion, because the employees have to have something to do, but it really has worked the reverse of that. It's been greater intrusion that has then required a more expensive government, a government with more employees, and those employees wielding more power. But smaller government was the vision because of the founders and the whole founding era's self-understanding, how they understood themselves as self-governing individuals, and also how they saw each state as a self-governing nation, if you will, as a self-governing state. And it is that combination of self-images, if you will, that led to this desire to limit the federal government.
So while they did not anticipate the growth of federal intrusion into the lives of U.S. citizens, they did enumerate powers, in particular to Congress, the subject of our conversation today. Why is that enumeration so important?
Well, that enumeration is central to limiting the government's power. In fact, today we tend to view the Bill of Rights as the primary way that our rights are secured and that federal power is limited. But really, one of the first ways was the enumeration of powers, that the federal government will only have those powers specifically laid out in the Constitution. In fact, James Madison was one of many who are of the mind that a Bill of Rights was not necessary, because the things that would be in a Bill of Rights were not powers that had been enumerated to the federal government. So, for instance, the federal government, among its enumerated powers, was not the power to regulate speech. So there would be no reason to have a First Amendment free speech protection. Ultimately, Madison was moved away from that position. But nevertheless, the fundamental importance of stating exactly what powers the government has, and by implication, all of the powers the government doesn't have, was of fundamental importance to liberty.
The irony there with respect to Madison is that while he was kind of naive about the need for a Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights does eventually contain the 10th Amendment, which is another bulwark in favor of the states keeping their powers.
Right. In fact, the 10th Amendment goes specifically to this scheme of enumerated powers, that any powers not given explicitly to the federal government are retained by the states.
Review the content of the Commerce Clause, and also the framers, when they understood this. We have drifted radically, I think, from the framers' understanding of the Commerce Clause, but what was it originally intended to speak to?
Okay, well, many of the powers of the federal government are enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. Article 1 describes the lawmaking branch of the government, that is, Congress, and Section 8 lists the powers of Congress. And one of those powers is to regulate commerce with foreign governments and commerce among the states. The main reason behind granting this power to Congress was to centralize control of foreign trade so that the states could not undermine one another in terms of foreign trade, and also to prevent individual states from hindering domestic trade. So tariffs on trade, state-level tariffs on trade, had been a significant problem under the Articles of Confederation. And remember that the Constitution that we have now was drafted in replacement of those Articles of Confederation. So the framers wanted Congress to be able to control or prevent problems similar to those that had arisen under the Articles.
Now, again, we have to kind of set ourselves into the context there where trade was conducted not in the way that it is today, even between the states, over railroads, interstate highways, air, and other forms of shipping. But this was a hand-to-hand kind of thing taking place, wasn't it?
Right. The main means of shipping was on ships. And the amount of that was so limited compared to what we have today that it's a wonder in a way that we can call them the same thing. Now, that being said, these huge differences still raised some similar issues regarding the relationship between the state and the federal government that we would have today. We just have them in a faster and far greater scale than they did in those days.
Was there a concept for the framers of a national economy, or did they think of it more of the economies of the individual states?
That's a good question. I think that they did have a concept of a national economy. Everything was primarily from the position of the states, plural, but they also saw things nationally. This goes back even to before the start of the War for Independence, where the American colonies got together through this Continental Congress, which itself was an innovation at the time, to have a unified front in trade relations with Great Britain, because trade relations were going to be the main means to get Great Britain to stop treating the colonists and the colonies the way they were being treated.
So if you would give us a picture of how the states were trading with one another so we know what it was the framers were attempting to regulate with the Commerce Clause, just a general picture on how they were trading with foreign powers as well.
Right. Well, a lot of the trade between states was between farming states, states that had more farming, and states that were more industrial. So, for instance, cotton from the South would be traded to the North and manufactured into textiles. And then from there, trade took place internationally with a variety of nations. Some of those nations were enemies of one another. So, for instance, we would trade with France, we would trade with England, even though France and England were not fond of one another.
We are talking about the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution in our series on the Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn. When we come back, the Commerce Clause is put to the test in a case called Gibbon versus Ogden. Stay tuned.
What is the state of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in 2018? Find out in the November issue of the Lutheran Witness. This special edition is filled with information on global mercy work, missions, membership statistics, schools, and more, offering readers a big picture look at the LCMS around the world. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I think every man, every Christian should consider, at least, the possibility of God calling him into the holy ministry.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fekencher of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Because that's the way that God has designed for faith in Christ Jesus to be spread, for the gift of eternal life that Christ Jesus earned by his death and resurrection to be shared with people by the washing of baptism for infants and for adults, for the instruction, the proclamation of the word that happens on a nonstop basis in God's kingdom. God uses people, he uses men to be those proclaimers, to be those men who share the sacraments.
If you've ever considered becoming a pastor, contact Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their phone number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our series on the U.S. Constitution. Today we're talking about the Commerce Clause. A little bit later, the 16th Amendment. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest, director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. Dr. Dawn, staying on the Commerce Clause, you say very early it was put to the test in a case called Gibbon versus Ogden. Tell us about that.
The Gibbons case involved a shipping arrangement. So basically, the state of New York had granted a monopoly on navigation of intrastate, so within New York, waterways. It had granted this monopoly to a particular individual, or a couple of individuals rather, that they would have exclusive right to navigation of these waterways within the state of New York. Well, at the same time, another individual had been granted a license by the federal government to engage in coastal commerce, if you will, to ship goods among the states there in the Northeast. So, for instance, between New Jersey and New York. Well, to ship something from New Jersey to New York entails navigating at least part of New York's waterways. And so that created a conflict. This other company has a license to ship goods, to carry goods on board a ship from New Jersey to New York, but another individual has the exclusive right, the monopoly right, to engage in this in shipping within New York. So what's going to happen? Are we actually going to have the one that's granted the federal license ship something to the edge of New York waters, and then everything gets transferred to another ship, and then they're going to finish the voyage? Of course not. That would be ridiculous in any technological age, but certainly in that age, it would have been impossible. So therein is the conflict. So does the Commerce Clause, which grants Congress the commerce power, the power to regulate interstate commerce, trump the state's monopoly granting power? And the court under Chief Justice Marshall said that it does, that Congress's power does trump the state power. And therefore, the monopoly has to give way. And this is a ruling that really had to be. Had it gone the other way, that the state's monopoly power trumps the federal commerce power, then really Congress would have had virtually no ability to actually regulate interstate commerce, commerce between the states. It would have required the Supreme Court to say something along the lines of, well, it's only going between the states that Congress can regulate things, not once there is, you know, actual penetration into a state. Well, there is no between the states. Everything is within one state or another state. So really, it was a case, as I say, that had to be decided the way it was.
How and why then did Congress become more aggressive in attempting to regulate the overall economy?
Well, for a long time, Congress really wasn't much more aggressive. That case, the Gibbons case, was 1824. And really, for nearly three quarters of a century after that, there were not huge intrusions by Congress into regulation of the economy, at least generally speaking. Especially once we get into the post-Civil War era, the era that historians dub the Gilded Age, it tended to be a very hands-off era. So it's as the Gilded Age begins to transition into the Progressive Era that we see those changes. So what is the Progressive Era? This is an era where scientific discoveries were proving so valuable, so immensely good in improving human life. And in addition to that, the theory of evolution was becoming so prominent, the idea that things can biologically transition from more simple to more complex, and from not as good, if you will, into better. Those two ideas, basically the advancement of science and evolutionary theory, had this tremendous influence on the mindset of the times in the 1880s, 1890s, going up into really all the way into the 1930s. It took time for this to settle into the American consciousness, but it really did in the form of this progressivism. And progressivism said that, A, if we take a scientific view of society and put the control of society into the hands of experts, then we can actually begin to take control of our own evolution and evolve into a better society and even a better humanity. So that idea of progress really began to dominate the scene. And so, with this emphasis on putting control into the hands of experts, well, the experts are going to be found in government. At least that was the belief. So we need, instead of the chaos of the Gilded Age, which was an age of great wealth creation, but also an age of increasing chaos, instead of that chaos, really, we can put the economy and society in general into the control of the federal government. And by doing so, we can improve our society as well as ourselves. And so that's what led to this increase of intrusiveness. It was a belief in the goodness of such intrusions.
Was this a pretty major philosophical departure from the enlightened pessimism of the framers?
Absolutely. The effects of the broader Enlightenment's rejection of God, and specifically the Christian God, and the idea of the fall, that rejection utterly transformed the way we view ourselves, because we view ourselves as not fallen, but ultimately perfectible. And that philosophical move transformed education and transformed reform movements really throughout the 19th century. This idea of perfectibility really took flight much earlier than the progressive era. And yes, it was a fundamental shift from the pessimism of the earlier age. That pessimism is what leads to the idea that we need to control government, that we can't put so much power into so few hands. Whereas the progressive optimism about human nature says that, hey, if we just have to do things the right way and great things will come. Well, the right way in this case is putting a lot of control into the hands of a few experts.
Is there a shift also from the way government is understood from representation, which is kind of the primary model for the framers, to government as experts?
Yes, at least a partial shift in that way. There was also at the time a great populism going on, and progressivism was embraced within this populism. And so what I mean by populism is sort of an anti-elitism. So as some of the massive companies of that time and the so-called robber barons, the Andrew Carnegie and the Rockefeller family, etc., as so much wealth and power ended up concentrated in the hands of these elites, there grew this populist movement that there needs to be more power among the people. But that was sort of subsumed, if you will, within progressivism, so that the idea was, if we are more democratic in terms of where our emphasis as a society is, that if we're more looking at the good and the influence of all the people rather than the good and the influence of the elites, we'll be better off, and that will play into our progress.
Give us some sense of, you talked earlier about the Gilded Age and the wealth creation there, and then an attempt to bring this really unprecedented, except for monarchs, you know, in the previous eras, unprecedented ability to concentrate wealth into the hands of very few, or into companies or into monopolies, things like that. How distressful that was to the average American to think about some guy off there who not only employs many people, but is kind of the chief recipient of the benefit of other people's labor.
Yes. Well, in earlier eras, particularly getting out, obviously, of the American context and going back to, say, old Great Britain, really the concentration of wealth and power was in the hands of the monarchy and the nobility. the nobles had their power and wealth at the pleasure, if you will, of the crown. It was the crown who granted noble titles, that sort of thing. And so there were huge concentrations of wealth and power, but they were different in the sense that those individuals had less control over the daily lives of the peasants. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have a great disparity of authority and power, but there simply wasn't the technological means by which to control people's lives in the minutia of their lives. And so that's a big difference from the old agrarian society with lords and serfs and the new industrial society where one goes to work in a factory without any access to the owners, without any means of giving feedback to the owners. The only feedback is to work and to work the hours that one was required to work, which often was 14 hours a day, usually 6 days a week. Although working 6 days a week was nothing new in history at all, other than societies that had to work 7 days a week just to survive. But really what's going on is this concentration of people in factories. Labor becomes less and less distinctive, if you will. It's very different to farm something, to grow something from spring to fall and then to harvest it and to see the fruits of one's labor than to simply hold a position in a factory doing repetitive things over and over again and really not ever see the fruits of that. In addition, people living in squalor in tenements in these big cities where things were in many ways worse than life had been back on the farm. So there was a good deal of chaos and really abuse of the relationship between employer and employed. I am in general a free market guy. I support the free market. I think it's good for society. And in many ways, it was good for society in the Gilded Age. As I say, there was great wealth creation. But human beings are fallen, and they're fallen whether they have power in government or power in corporations. And the power that those corporations had, without any real check on that power, ended up being abused. And so the workers were abused. Now, whether America came up with the right solution to the problems of that abuse is another matter, but the abuse was patent.
So do we find at this time, during this time of transition, when Congress kind of swoops in to help not just regulate the economy for its own ends, but regulate the economy because they are a representative body of the electorate, do we find this being a major topic of conversation where people are kind of seeking redress against things like terrible working conditions or long hours from government itself?
Absolutely. It became the mindset that really the enemies of liberty were the corporations. They were faceless, they were powerful, and people viewed them as taking away their liberty. Now, that's a different sort of thing than government taking away liberty, but we should also remember that the relationships between many of these huge corporations and government were quite cozy, and I think illegitimately cozy. So that increased the power of these corporations all the more.
So that's another kind of contemporary concern that people often voice, especially around election time, that's money in politics. Sounds like it was a really bad situation then, too.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you have power, wealth is going to have an influence on that power. So if it's a democratic power, then there will be those with greater wealth than others who are able to take some of that power away from the people. Or there may be accumulations of people who can take away power from other groups of people. But no matter what, where there is power and where there is wealth, those two things will find each other.
So the theory seemed to be that government needed to get bigger to balance out the titans of industry. I wonder, and we'll find out when we come back, would the framers have agreed? Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. It's our series on the U.S. Constitution. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
In Islam, forgiveness is arbitrary. In Christianity, it is in perfect keeping with God's exorbitant, excessive, and extravagant grace.
Hank Hanegraaff of the Bible Answer Man, speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And while neither Sunni nor Shia are monolithic respecting details of their end-time scenarios, they are united in reducing Jesus to the administrative deputy of Muhammad and thoroughly human associate of the Muslim Mahdi. Jesus is demoted from the creator of all things, including Muhammad, to a mere caste member in the Muslim eschatological charade.
You can listen to Making the Case Against Islam with Hank Hanegraaff on an audio DVD or thumb drive of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a financial gift of $300. Order today at issuesetc.org.
The Lord is our shepherd, and we are the people of his pasture. Why then do we still suffer in this life? Disease, loneliness, persecution. I'm Katie Schuerman, and I'm collaborating with Cheryl Swope, Molly Hemingway, and a host of literary friends in He Restores My Soul, a book that takes an honest look at hardship and heartache in light of God's promises found in his word. He Restores My Soul is now available at emmanuelpress.us, emmanuelpress.us.
Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you are a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with excellent professional credentials, please consider applying for our faculty or staff family. Current openings are posted at cuchicago.edu/hr.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Peace Lutheran, Sussex, Wisconsin. Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Grace Lutheran, Elgin, Texas. Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois. Emmanuel Lutheran, Alexandria, Virginia. St. John Lutheran, Mayville, Wisconsin. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Fayetteville, North Carolina. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Perrysburg, Ohio. Trinity Lutheran, Okmulgee, Oklahoma. Zion Lutheran, Gwinner, South Dakota. Trinity Lutheran, St. Charles, Missouri. And Christ Lutheran, Normal, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at the website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Thanksgiving Day. It's part six of our series on the U.S. Constitution. We're talking about the Commerce Clause and its expansion of Congress's authority in the federal government. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. Dr. Dawn, so we've established that the framers could not have anticipated all the changes that came about with the Industrial Revolution. But had they been transported forward to that time when the Commerce Clause was being so greatly expanded, when the philosophy or the theory was that government needs to get bigger to balance these titans of industry, would the founders and the framers, would they have agreed?
That's a good question. I tend to think in terms of James Madison's Federalist Number 10, where he talks about the importance of a large republic. So there had been anti-federalist attacks on the Constitution as creating a republic that was too large to actually function well. That in history, republics had always been small, except the Roman Republic was large, and we saw what happened there. It fell into an imperial mindset and an imperial governance. So in response to that, James Madison wrote Federalist Number 10, which said, actually, a large republic is useful for liberty, because in a large republic, there will be so many different factions that no one faction will be able to gain, or at least not permanently gain, power over government. Basically, you will not have one group of people exercising, if you will, monopoly power over another group of people. Now, he wasn't talking about corporations. He was talking about political factions, special interest groups, we would say today. His solution was, well, you can't get rid of factions, you can't get rid of special interest groups, but you can have a situation where there are many of them vying for power. And I actually think Madison might have thought that the ideas behind Federalist 10 would have covered the corporate revolution of the late 19th century, where basically corporations are just factions. They're just special interest groups. And the solution to factions like those is not fewer factions, but more factions. We need more companies being competitive with these companies. And so really, had we been able to get rid of the crony capitalism going on, the cronyism between corporations and government, the monopolies might not have been nearly so bad, and we might not have needed the government solutions that we got. I use, for example, the modern technological age. In the 1960s and 70s, no one knew whether anyone would ever be able to supplant IBM as the behemoth in the technological world. My students don't even know what IBM is, and because it was followed, of course, by Microsoft. Well, even Microsoft has lost its power. Now it's Apple and Google and Amazon, and who knows what will follow these. Today we think Google has too much power and is a threat to liberty, perhaps, but 10 years from now, Google may be an afterthought.
As a pause here, Dr. Dawn, it seems to make perfect sense why, although tragically and fatally wrongheaded, why movements like socialism and communism were put forth elsewhere as solutions to the so-called capitalist problem.
Yes, and capitalism can have problems. Basically, unfettered freedom is going to lead to abuse of that freedom because of our fallen nature. And it is very understandable why people would come up with basically a concentration of power in the form of socialism or in the form of trade unionism, those sorts of things. Well, we need to concentrate power against these other things that have concentrated so much power, these corporations. Those aren't necessarily the best long-term solutions, but it's understandable why they get proposed as solutions.
So then give us a picture of the growth of the Commerce Clause from this New York dispute in the U.S. Supreme Court to what it eventually became.
Yes, well, we'll eventually reach the New Deal era under President Franklin Roosevelt. So we've had the Roaring Twenties, which were roaring because in large part of an economy turned loose from excessive regulation, then to the stock market crash and the Great Depression. And in order to try to fix the Great Depression, President Roosevelt had in mind his New Deal, where the government, again, takes control of the economy and makes things better. And so it is during this era that we see the greatest expansion of federal commerce power. So in 1935, there is a case that has been dubbed in sort of in legal circles as the sick chicken case. And in this case, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected a federal law regulating the business practices of a New York company that slaughtered chickens and sold them locally. So the slaughter of chickens is really not technically commerce. It's more along the lines of sort of manufacturing, although it's not technically manufacturing. And then selling them locally, well, that's commerce, but it is not interstate commerce. So there was a federal law under the New Deal to regulate that sort of business. And the Supreme Court unanimously rejected that. Their business did affect interstate commerce, but only indirectly, the court said. But then only 2 years later, the court upheld a federal law regulating labor management relations at a manufacturing plant. So this is very much a local situation. It involves manufacturing, not commerce. The things that get manufactured eventually go into commerce, but the manufacturing itself is not commerce, but rather industry. And then labor management relations are clearly not commerce. They are what they are, labor management relations. And so Congress had passed and FDR had signed a law that regulated these sorts of relations. And the court within just those 2 years had swung such that it was a 5-4 decision upholding that regulation. And that was really the beginning of the end for enumerated powers and for the commerce power as a serious impediment to government growth, to government intrusion. So by 1942, we have a case called Wickard v. Filburn. And in that case, the court upheld the application of a federal law that restricted grain production. The way this law was being applied was that a farmer who grew grain only to use in feeding his own family, not for sale, not for trade, not for commerce of any sort, that farmer was fined. Well, he was fined for doing so because it violated the restrictions on grain production. Basically, by growing wheat, he was taking himself out of the market for buying wheat. And that undermined a federal scheme for supporting wheat prices. At this point, when the Supreme Court upheld that law, that application of the law in such an intrusive way, it became clear that there was really very little that the federal government couldn't regulate under the commerce power.
We're talking about the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution in our series on the Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. If you enjoy the subjects of law and history, be sure to order a recording of this year's Making the Case conferences. You'll find teachings by Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation on our first freedoms, revisionist history with Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, and Dr. John Warwick Montgomery of 1517, The Legacy Project, on a legal case for the resurrection of Christ. We'll send you a thumb drive or an audio DVD for a year-end tax-deductible donation of $300 or more to Issues, etc. Order at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or give us a call, 618-223-8385. Almost 20 hours of teaching and preaching, never heard before on Issues, etc., on a recording of our 2018 Making the Case conferences. When we come back, we've been talking about that Supreme Court decision that allowed Congress to penalize someone even if they weren't engaged in interstate trade. I will invoke the framers again. Would that have horrified them?
The origin of confusion, I would say, it stretches way back to Genesis 3.
Pastor Trevor Sutton, author of the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month, Clearly Christian, Following Jesus in This Age of Confusion.
Satan tried to inject falsehood into the true word that God had spoken. But in that little statement, did God actually say this? Suddenly we see this swirl of confusion coming into our world.
Learn more about Clearly Christian at issuesetc.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Several Issues, Etc. regular guests are candidates for leadership positions in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Every LCMS congregation has received nomination forms for the president and vice presidents of the Synod. Please encourage your pastor and congregational leaders to fill out and return these nomination forms before February 20th of 2019. Learn more at issuesetc.org/nominations. issuesetc.org/nominations.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/Luther Academy.
We're talking about the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution in part six of our series on the Constitution with Dr. Russell Dawn. Dr. Dawn, before the break, we were talking about the Supreme Court decision wherein it was deemed within Congress's power essentially to penalize citizens who didn't engage in interstate commerce, who grew wheat, I think, in this case, for their own use and were penalized, therefore. I'm going to invoke the framers one more time. Would that decision have horrified them?
Oh, absolutely. The idea that the government would punish someone for really living an independent life, for being independent, for governing himself in such a way that he's actually providing independently for his family. That would truly be horrifying. Imagine an agrarian, almost a utopian agrarian like Thomas Jefferson, hearing that that's where the government got them within less than two centuries. He might have thrown the whole thing away had he known that.
I'm wondering, so not only was the Congress then here asserting and the court supporting the Congress's assertion that they should be able to regulate money and goods changing hands, now they're able to regulate money and goods not changing hands.
Right.
That brings us to the necessary and proper clause. Review for us what it is and why it became the means by which Congress could assert its legislative power in these places.
Yes, the Necessary and Proper Clause is part of the Article 1 powers, Article 1, Section 8 powers, that Congress can make any laws that are necessary and proper to carrying out the enumerated powers. So it's an expansion of the enumerated powers, and one that the Anti-Federalists were very vehemently against. That power was interpreted, again, by Chief Justice Marshall and his court in a very generous way to Congress. Necessary and proper, those words were construed loosely. It doesn't mean absolutely necessary. It means really more along the lines of useful, if you will, of needed in a general sense rather than necessary in a philosophical or Aristotelian sense. So the Necessary and Proper Clause is an add-on, if you will. It's an expansion of enumerated powers, but all laws passed under the Necessary and Proper Clause have to be related to one of the enumerated powers. So it is an expansion of federal authority, but it is still a somewhat limited one until we get the unlimited nature of the commerce power. So now not only can Congress regulate anything that substantially affects interstate commerce, those are the kind of the buzzwords that the court uses, if it substantially affects interstate commerce, but it can also pass any laws that are needed, that are necessary and proper to further that commerce power. So really it's an expansion upon an expansion. And those two things together have really led to this federal Leviathan that we have today.
So this is why, at least as things stand today, there is virtually no matter that at least Congress can't attempt to deal with according to the Commerce Clause.
Right, pretty close. There have been cases since the 1990s that have successfully challenged the commerce power, but those cases are rare and of very limited scope. Really, just about every economic activity can be touched by the federal power.
Let's turn to the 16th Amendment, which is related to this in so many different ways. But what was the 16th Amendment?
Well, this is a progressive era amendment, the first amendment passed since the Civil War amendments. So the 15th Amendment ensured the right to vote for all people, regardless of race. And then decades go by without any more amendments, and we come to 1913. And the 16th Amendment gets adopted. This amendment grants the federal government the power to tax income, which it had been interpreted as not having that power before. It did have the taxing power, but not specifically the power to tax income. And so as part of the move to centralize power in government so that government can help us develop into a better society, the idea was that we should tax income. This started off very small, but obviously it has grown. And the importance of this is that that has provided the food that has led to the growth of this federal beast. The commerce power, together with the necessary and proper power, could only do so much damage. Now, it could do some damage, but it could only do so much damage in terms of individual liberty and state-level liberty without this vast increase in the financial resources available to the federal government.
If the 16th Amendment were attempted today in 21st century America, it would probably just be beaten down. Why was it considered necessary?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the populism at the time, sort of an egalitarian strain that, you know, these few were making so much money, and so taxing that money and bringing it within the power of the people represented by government, there was a strong impetus toward that, as well as this idea of government being able to improve things. And in many ways, we've not changed from that. I think many of us who are tired of paying so much in federal income taxes would certainly vote down the ability for the government to tax us to that great extent. At the same time, if people knew the extent to which they are reliant on the federal government, they might think twice about that. We have become a very dependent people, dependent upon our government and our various aspects of government, state and federal. And so I think there would be a great hue and cry as well. So I think a federal income tax might pass today in spite of ourselves.
How did the 16th Amendment then serve to further the expansion of federal regulation?
Well, it provided the purse. There's just no way to pay enough people to intervene in the daily lives of employees, employers, individuals across this enormous country with all the economic activity going on. It just requires a huge number of employees, as well as budget that goes beyond employment. It's really the amount of money being spent on regulating is immense.
So you mentioned earlier our dependence, and that is not always necessarily a bad thing. What have been the positive and negative effects of a stronger Congress with respect to commerce, or what it calls commerce,
right,
and generally a stronger federal government?
Yeah, well, many good things have come. As much as I tend to favor small government, I can't deny the good things that have come. So, for instance, it is under the commerce power that Congress made it illegal for hotels to discriminate against racial minorities during the civil rights era. So, you know, hotels are part of the stream of commerce, if you will. If someone is traveling, they stop at hotels. There is goods flow into hotels, and, you know, in the form of just all the supplies of a hotel and all the food that the restaurants in the hotel use, etc. So very much a part of interstate commerce, and it's a very good thing that we no longer have a Jim Crow scheme where people of a particular race cannot go to hotels because someone of another race owns that hotel. So that is a good and important thing in our history. Another one is that, you know, in spite of my many beefs with the Environmental Protection Agency, I can't deny that the air quality, for instance, in the greater Los Angeles area where I live, is far better now than it was in the 1970s. People who've lived here since the 70s talk about how much better it is now, talk about how the mountains were not visible back then on so many days of the year because of smog, and it's just not like that anymore. So these are good things. On the negative side, we live in an America with a far more powerful government than was originally envisioned, and that means that we are dependent, and I think that there is something culturally problematic about being too dependent. I think it is bad for us. It makes us lazy, if you will, and it makes us less self-governing. If someone else is governing us, then we don't have to govern ourselves, and we're not forced to make choices that build character as much as we are if we have more independence. So I think it's a cultural negative to have such a powerful government.
In our last two conversations, including the Civil War amendments and then the expansion of the Commerce Clause, and the 16th Amendment. Have we really talked about, in both of those conversations, a major transformation of the U.S. government as conceived of not only in the Constitution, but by its framers?
Absolutely. Really a revolutionary change. Now, not as fast of a revolution as, say, the War for Independence, but over those decades, from the beginning of the Civil War to, say, the end of World War II, really everything changed. And perhaps everything had to change. Perhaps all the idealism around self-governance was simply not possible to sustain in an industrial and now digital age. That's possible. We can't really deal with counterfactual history because we just don't know how other things would have turned out. But regardless of whether it was inevitable or not, it is a change, and we should not discount the extent of that change. Now, all this being said, I would hasten to add that as Christians, we need to always keep our eye on the ball. The size and reach of the federal government and the things that the government does are not the ball. They're important in an earthly sense, which is why I'm dedicated to teaching about them. But they aren't the ball. Christ is the ball. And to keep our eye on the ball means to live a Christian life, a life lived at the foot of the cross, serving our neighbors, regardless of how politics affect our relationship with our neighbors.
Dr. Russell Dawn is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado and is a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, thanks.
My pleasure, Todd.
Up next on this Thanksgiving Day, we're going to look forward to the last Sunday of the church year, talking with Dr. Carl Fikencher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the coming of the Son of Man, the lesson of the fig tree, and no one knows the day or the hour in Mark chapter 13. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.